Hi, everybody. It is... hi, everybody. It's Robert Saget. It's Robert Saget's Here For You, the French version of Bob Saget's Here For You. This is a podcast. This is a podcast. Everybody has one. Literally, all of you listening have a podcast. So this is just another one that hopefully entertains on in my brand of whatever. I guess my new brand of podcasting is listening. And then I'll throw something in and people say, I like it better when he listens. And I do love listening, especially when I have a guest like I have today, Jason Alexander. I've known Jason a long time, but he's a sweetheart. He's got such a big heart, and he's incredibly articulate about what he cares about and why. He's always doing stuff. He's about to do a play of Where the Roses on Broadway. He's working on that. He's got a new podcast coming out. I believe it's called Oh Really? Really? And that would be with Peter Tilden. And so you'll be able to hear that fairly soon. I think it's coming out in the next month or so. And I just love the man. And all I can tell you is he's about to come into my little Zoom room here. That's how we do things, right? Hey, do you want to Zoom? No, it's just us. Let's FaceTime. But that's not what this is. This is a podcast that you can watch on the YouTube page if you love a two-shot that doesn't move. That would be at youtube.com/Bob Saget. And, of course, you can rate, review, and subscribe. You subscribe, and then you can listen. Or if you're on another thing, you can follow it and then listen. I'm very specific about this. And that's it. I really appreciate all of the kind words I've been getting from many of you and very sweet stuff about losing Norm MacDonald. Let's hope we don't have to do many more of those eulogies, but life is what it is, but gone way too soon, and sending lots of love to all the people that were in his immediate orbit, his family, and to all of you that loved him, because that one hurt. They all hurt, right? But it's good to have people that you love, so keep your friends close. And I've got one coming in right now who will warm your heart because he's a positive energy. Boy, do I sound cosmic. And Nine Perfect Strangers, we're here to love, but we are. And Jason Alexander is a man who has a giant capacity for love. So please welcome, if you would, my friend Jason Alexander. Jason, this is our first blurred episode. I'm really excited.
It is very exciting. It's very exciting.
And Zoom, how do they make money? Do you pay for Zoom?
You pay for the premium Zoom, which allows you to go more than 45 minutes.
Oh, I've got that then.
Right?
Well, yeah, I go more than 45.
You have a business manager, and you like me have no idea what they're doing. I think they're in Cancun right now.
They're gone. They're in Tulum.
Yeah.
Because you can't find them from Cancun. You look wonderful.
You're very kind.
I know from the waist down, we're both a mess, but upward for the Zooms.
Nothing has changed. I can't blame that on the pandemic. That was a plague before this came in.
Oh, I don't want to mention the pandemic because we don't know when this is going to run. Oh, my grandmother. What a world. What a world. And we haven't really connected. We've texted, and you're always a sweetheart. But oh, man, I can't.
What have you been doing other than this?
I've been on tour doing stand-up.
You're a brave man. I'm about to go out on a tour.
Right.
And I did my first audience last week in Portland. And it's a thing. It's a thing.
It is. I was up there last week also. I think a week and a half ago, Portland.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because we're living through history. So you see downtown and you go, so this is where that happened, and this is where that happened.
Yep.
Wow. Okay. And they're working on everybody's working on trying to dig out of all this.
What else can we do?
and what is the show? Are you back to that wonderful character?
No, you're so sweet. So no, you're talking about the Donnie Clay thing, which was a purely theatrical stand-up show where I played a very bad motivational speaker. Donnie sort of played his way out. And Donnie was more of a show. It needed props and it needed screens and it needed all kinds of things. So no, this show is, it's kind of an organized Q&A show that needs no moderator. So it came from years of me being asked for no godly reason to be keynote speaker for different things. Organizations, charities, businesses, colleges. And I would go, in every case, I go, well, what do you want me to talk about? And sometimes they say, oh, your career, Seinfeld, whatever. But other times it was, well, we know you, you've done a lot of work in the Middle East as an activist and you're political, or we know you wrote a children's book, or actually, you know what? We know we've been watching you play poker and maybe there's something about. So whatever that was that they would ask me to do, I would prep that. And then you do the meet and greets after. And, you know, you'd always get, the whole world becomes Jewish on a meet and greet because they all go, I had such a wonderful time, but you have such a lovely voice. I wish you had sung something. Or, you didn't have to be so funny. I like the serious. Nobody was happy. So,
and these are not Jewish people.
They become Jewish on a meet and greet line.
The accent, they all turn into Nancy Walker.
That is correct.
That's a reference for no one listening.
Except Valerie Harper. Rest
she was, Nancy Walker was brilliant. All right, yep. Please continue.
So what I did finally is I said, okay, here's like 25 things that people seem to be interested in. They each have a story. The story actually is a little bit of a life lesson for me, which might mean that it is impactful for the person hearing it. And I put them in the program. Here's the list. And I come out, I do an opening number, and I go, here's how this works. I don't want guilt anymore. I don't want to be disappointing people. So we're going to go around the room during the course of the night and look at the list. Some of them are funny. Some of them are not. Some of them have songs. Some of them, most do not. Some of them, one is a magic thing. One is another thing. One is a thing. I'll call on you. You pick one. You can also ask me something that's not on the list. You can do that too. But at least you have a list, and we can get, depending on what they pick, we can get through anywhere from 4 to 8 of these things in 75 minutes. And if the night is great and everybody had a great time, I was really good. Right. If they didn't have a great time, they picked the wrong stuff. That's
their fault.
That's how it works.
Right.
So, you know, and my wife's phone is going off. Not my phone, my wife's phone.
But why is your wife's phone right there? Is it a burner phone?
Now you've asked an important question, because this phone, wherever my wife is, like a breadcrumb, the phone remains and she moves on. She will come in here in a moment to say, did you hear my phone? I guarantee you.
And she's wonderful. You have a wonderful wife.
Which is why I can't say schnai. I go, yes, sweetheart, here's your phone.
That's me calling. I call your wife. Whoops.
It's all good.
Darn. Yep. So you're waiting for her right now to come for her phone.
I think that was someone calling her. She has no idea. She has no idea that this
That's
is
so
her
interesting.
Phone.
My wife would never leave the phone like next to me.
She drops it.
Well, what if she goes somewhere? What if she's going somewhere? You want to be able to know where she is?
Many times she'll stop by a friend and go, can I use your phone for a second to call me, and go, do you have my phone?
So she just forgets it.
She just forgets it. Yeah.
Which means if it's on your desk and you were sitting there, was she on your lap? Is that what was happening right before she left her phone?
Yes, she was. Yeah. I like, you know, before I do a podcast, I like a little nookie. And
do you have any video? Can you add video? We'll just roll it in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it really helps with the YouTube hits. Oh, God in heaven. So you're always busy. What? Always. I mean, you're in the middle of a celebrity game show. That's a fun one. Didn't you just do it?
It just aired. I did this. I did Celebrity Wheel of Fortune.
Right.
That was the thing. And it went well, and I did not think it would go well. There are game shows I do where I go, I'm going to crush this thing. And that was not one where I went in with confidence, but I did manage to do very well. So.
Right. I've done a couple, and I went in to do Match Game with Alec Baldwin, mm-hmm. and he is so nice to me. He goes, come on, you comedy genius. And that's the kiss of death. And I just sat there, and all of these people, Tom Lennon, they're just running circles around me, and I'm sitting there, and I just kind of like, I'm thinking to myself, I don't belong here.
Well, here's the problem with that game, and you must experience it too, because I know you being a man of the people, you're actually trying to help the contestant. There's the funny answer, which will make you look like a hero, and then there's the one they might have said.
Right.
And what do you go for? Do you sacrifice the funny one? Because it's an entertainment show in the guise of a game show. So do you ditch the funny stuff and try and match them? Or do you go, hell with you, I'm here to be entertaining. It's an unknowable show, Match Game. That's why the pyramid was the perfect game.
Yes, it was. I never played that. And I was asked.
I killed on the pyramid.
Yes, you did.
I loved it. Loved it.
You should have gotten an Emmy for that.
Listen, we're going to start making that list.
So what happens to you every year? I mean, I knew Full House. I was never getting nothing. You know, video show.
Yeah, I might have had.
They created a category for hosting the video show specifically after I left. But you had, was it seven? You Seinfeld?
I think it was seven for Seinfeld and one for something else, a guest thing.
Now, every year.
Yeah.
I mean, the show
is on. By the way, first award up. So 5 minutes into the show, you're a loser. Enjoy your evening.
And you, what I mean, if you put all seven clips together of you sitting there, is it just like, no? Are you thinking, or are you going, this could be cool?
You're a hopeful person anyway. There was one year where I thought this could happen. I think it was the third time I was nominated. The first time I went, I don't think anybody's watching this show. I can't believe I'm here. The third time I was nominated, I had a very good season. There were a couple of really good episodes, you know, and I'm sure one of them got submitted. And I thought, that puts me in the running. But I forgot who I was up against. And I was always up against, and here's who beat me every time. It was either David Hyde Pierce on Frasier, who's glorious, mm-hmm. or Michael Richards. And frankly, I don't know how Michael didn't win every year, because David Hyde Pierce is doing great, funny work as an actor. I hopefully am doing great, funny work as an actor. So are the three or four other guys nominated. Michael is doing something none of us are capable of doing. What he is doing is so specific and individual and unique. If you're going to give an award for being special, he's got to win. So, and he did many times.
Well, there should be a special category.
Yeah, sure.
He should have been nominated for best entrances and exits. I mean,
absolutely that. But you know, Michael had this rare opportunity that he took enormous, beautiful advantage of, to create a character that was more physicalized than almost anything else on television. So you know, when people speculate with me about why did Seinfeld become an international hit, I go, Kramer. It's the international comedy of physical comedy. I mean, you know, he's a clown. He was a clown. He was Red Skelton. And so I think he was our entree to the international market.
I think you're being not kind enough to yourself and to everybody. I mean, that truly was, you could not do that show without all of the parts.
Absolutely.
It's one of the best ensembles and funniest that will ever be done ever. And your work, and I'd known you long before that. We'd met, we kind of were social.
Yeah.
Just enough to catch herpes. But you were always,
which is treatable, by the way, not curable, but treatable.
Right. There's a pill apparently, but I've never needed it because I have syphilis, but I don't worry about that.
Why would you?
Because I don't think people talk about that, which means they're not communicable.
No. Because no one's communicating about it. That's right. Oh, see?
but you're such a good actor, and you're so specific. It's truth. And your comedy, I mean, and George was so lovable. So we're talking about somebody who starts trouble, but he's still everyman. So everybody knows a George. Right. Everybody does not know Michael Richards. They might know Julia. You know, they might know Elaine. And Jerry is also one of a kind because, you know, there are people like Jerry, but Jerry is very emphatic to this day to tell you exactly how he feels or doesn't care.
What do you mean? How are you going to say that?
We already had that conversation.
Right.
So here's a question I get asked. They ask me, do I keep in touch with the Seinfeld cast? No, that's not the one. Do you guys talk? Has there ever been reunion talk? All that crap.
No, but I talk to Stamos every day, which is so funny. as far as an official, you know, sort of a show reunion, I haven't heard any talk. I know that everybody, particularly Jerry and Larry, consider the arc we did on Curb Your Enthusiasm to be, that was the reunion. And God bless it. It was really good. You know, knowing the guys, they don't like to follow a trend. They like to set a trend. And there've been so many reunions and reboots that unless they had a glorious idea of how to do it in a special way, I just don't think they would follow that trend. So I don't think that's where their heads are. On a personal level, you know, this always makes people go, oh. I love them dearly, all of them. Mm-hmm. We were never social friends in that sense. We were workmate friends. We didn't shoot the show on a Friday night and say, hey, let's have dinner tomorrow night. We just never did that. Now, there are many reasons why that probably didn't happen. For Julia and myself, we were married. We were raising young children during the show. And so every spare moment that I wasn't working, I wanted to be home. And I'm sure she did too. So it wasn't a habit. We would always go out after the show. We'd always go to Jerry's Deli up on, you know, on Ventura. And we loved being together and we had great times on the set. And, you know, there were a couple of times where we would go and grab a dinner in the off season as a group at someone's house, but it wasn't a habit. So when the show ended, because we didn't have that as a habit, it didn't become a habit. I have certainly emailed them. I have seen them. Larry has hired me a number of times. I've done charity stuff for Jerry. Jerry's done charity stuff for me. I've worked with Julia on another couple of occasions. We've done charity stuff together. I've worked with Michael on another occasion. So it's always wonderful and warm and supportive. And there's nothing that I feel regretful about other than, and you will appreciate this. So the other question we get is, you know, do you guys hang out? But it comes hard on the heels of, do you miss doing the show? And the truth is, I don't miss doing the show because I feel like we did the show. I feel like it felt complete. What you miss, and I knew we would miss it, was that family. And that family was not only the core four of us, but it was our writers. It was our crew, most of whom were with us all nine seasons. It was a lot of our bench, this glorious, you know, Wayne Knight and Patrick Warburton and Jerry Stiller, rest his soul. And, you know, that whole gang was just a delicious group of people to be around and have the occasion to play with. And I knew when the show ended, you know, it was going to be pretty hard to keep those relationships going. Now, a couple of them have, you know, I managed to stay in touch with. But for the most part, that's what you miss, is just being with this kind of great group of people without having to cook something.
No potluck.
Yeah, right.
So I always wonder this. I was on a family show that people loved, but it wasn't obviously your show. That show was, you must have been delighted with every script that came for a table read when you first got it? Was it like they did it again? How? And they would punch it up all week, I know. But
yeah. We were always, I don't know. I can't talk for everybody. I was, you know, people would say, "You guys are brilliant. You guys are brilliant." And I go, you know, you don't have to be a genius athlete. If the guy throws the ball to the 2-yard line, you can fall into the end zone. You know?
Right.
And they were always throwing the ball to the 2-yard line. The scripts were rock solid. And what was always interesting about the scripts is if you look at a printed Seinfeld script, almost always you go, where are the jokes? Because they're not obvious. They're not like ba-boom punchlines. They are all very character driven. And it was kind of like the writers knew very quickly where we might spin this thing to. And that trust that we knew what was in their heads and they knew what was in our capability was glorious. And there were certain scripts that you just couldn't believe. They were just gifts from God. We heard about the masturbation episode for months before it showed up. And we just went, there's no way. How are they going to do this? You can't even say the word, you know, on television. And that script came down for the table read and our heads exploded because it was brilliant and so bold to be about that subject. And, you know, if you remember, Elaine was in the contest and the idea of girls masturbating was run for the hills, you know, right. That was verboten. So it was just so, such an amazing piece of work when it showed up. And there were many like that, but there's also, you know, you talk about the tinkering process, which they would surely do all week long and it would always get better. But one of the biggest moments in any episode was in the marine biologist, the very last scene where Kramer's been hitting golf balls into the ocean and George has been pawning himself off as a marine biologist to this woman. And they wind up on a beach and there's a beached whale. And somebody goes, is there a marine biologist here? And I go trotting off into the water. That in the original script that we filmed in front of the audience, that's where my storyline ended. There was no scene in the restaurant.
Right.
And then they had a scene in the restaurant that I was not in. It went fine, but it didn't kill. And Jerry and Larry went, nope, not good enough. And they circled the writers. And on the floor with the audience in the stands, they wrote that scene, which we never rehearsed. And in one take, we put it out there. And it has, when that golf ball came out of my pocket, ostensibly the one I pulled from the blowhole of the whale.
Yeah.
That audience laugh in studio was over a minute long, where you couldn't go on with the script because the laughs were just too big. Mm-hmm. I mean, to come up with a joke like that on the fly, yeah. that was extraordinary. And that was the guys. Their work ethic and their comedic ethic, you know, I learned a ton watching them do their thing.
I have to ask, because I was always curious, because a lot of people have trouble with endings of shows. You heard this. This was probably your most asked question by anybody that's ever talked to you. No one's ever happy with the end of a series. No one. And some shows don't have an ending. There is no closure. You could have done whatever you wanted. I mean, Jerry and Larry could have kept it going another year, whatever they wanted, 2 years. It felt totally apropos to me, and it's an artist's medium at the end of the day, especially when it's your last episode. And we're talking about supreme comedy artists that exist. So what was your initial reaction to the reading of that when you first saw it? Was it like, well, this is sad, or it must have been melancholy in some ways?
I had two reactions to it.
Hives
and then a pounding headache. But low, like in the carotid.
I wish I would have been there. I know where to push.
My first reaction to it was, huh, they worked awfully hard to tie this thing up with some sort of, although a dark bow, a bow. You know, what's the ending? The four of us are in jail.
Right.
Finally getting our comeuppance for being the miserable, selfish, unethical pricks that we are. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because I always thought the perfect Seinfeld ending would be an episode that has no smack of ending on it, that ends with the four of us in the coffee shop. And there'd be a pause in the conversation where we all look at each other with nothing to say. And Jerry would go, all right, that's enough. And that would be the end of the show. But they had really worked, or Larry had worked really hard to come up with a plotted, this is the end of the show show. And on that level, I thought, it may work, it may not work, I don't know. I mean, I at that point, I trusted them implicitly. So, but I was very moved by that script. And that's why when people say to me, do I like the finale? I can't be, you know, I'm too in it, I'm too in the forest for the trees, because what it did, we were, as you know, the players, you know, Jerry and you know, Larry, this was a very unsentimental group of people.
Yeah, exactly.
And there was a, you know, it's now famous, there was a sign in Latin over the writer's room door that said, no hugging, no learning, right? That was verboten.
And you are a sentimental man, and you're a hugger.
I go there. And
you're
in fact,
a Jewish man that says verbotum.
Yeah, is, right? And you know, not to say that there wasn't wonderful heart and moments among us, but we were a fairly unsentimental group. And what Larry had found that I thought was extraordinary was an organic way to bring back every great player that had been on the show, who either with an arc or a scene or sometimes a single line had elevated the impact of our show. They had been a big part of our success by coming and playing with us. And he found a way to bring them all back to celebrate the ending with us. And I was so touched by that and thrilled by that, that to me, I go, great episode, you know, but that has nothing to do with the audience's experience. That's just the inside experience. So I was very pleased with it. But I can completely acknowledge that it's probably not our greatest episode. That's for sure.
I loved it. And I didn't understand all the hoopla, because it made,
I don't think we could have done anything. The hoopla was so big and the anticipation was so big. You know, there was a porn film made of the Seinfeld show that, you know, lookalikes for us. And I thought, unless we do that, everything's going to underwhelm. So
that's one step above the Lifetime movie version of the character,
exactly.
Which I've had done to me. I just, on a small sidebar, I was a part of How I Met Your Mother. I was the narrator.
Yeah.
So 9 years of that. And people were outraged at that last episode. They were incredibly upset. And I went to the reading. And the reason I went to the reading is I was kind of part of the show.
Yeah.
I knew all the people. Allison Hannigan was my babysitter when she was 16. It was an emotional, completely emotional script. And everybody, the entire cast, you know, everyone was crying. And it was so sad, but it was something that Carter and Craig, the exec producers, had devised from the very beginning. Why is he talking to his kids this whole time? And so it felt completely natural to me. And I also knew I wasn't going to be narrating it, that Josh Radner was finally going to be put on his big boy pants and do what a lot of people go, why didn't he do it in the first place?
Right.
And I loved it. I thought it was beautiful. And then they go and make it. And it should have been an hour because it got so serious.
Right.
But it was, and then they did another version on the DVD where I do narrate the whole episode. Because I tracked the whole thing, but they just couldn't figure out what to do. But people are not happy with their favorite shows, unless now with streamers, you got your ending. You know where you're going.
But you know, everybody has something to say. That's
like, that's our next giant topic.
That's the thing is, I am obsessed with this Netflix show Money Heist that they shot out of.
Yeah, I'm about to watch that as soon as my
wife gets
home.
Holy crap. So I won't spoil anything for you. But to me, it's one of the best crafted, you know, as far as character development, character arcs, story arcs. They write themselves into corners and then they kind of ingeniously write themselves out.
That's the best.
And everybody I know goes, yeah, but would she really have done? Oh, he wouldn't have done. The clock didn't work. And I go, you know, go fuck yourself.
I am at that point. It's like, pick up a laptop and write a fucking script.
Yeah.
And then you go exactly. Act in a show and go direct it and go conceive that 12 episode arc or whatever it is. Because it's exhausting already. It's not funny. Well, why don't you try to make somebody laugh? You know, but that's where we're at. Even the comedy people, their backs are up.
I know. Well, yeah, because comedy, we all know. I mean, I can't believe you're out there doing.
Well, that one is. We're going to take a quick break because I sell things like you either want to groom up your nether regions or mental health, which go together.
They do.
Meat products, which again, right on the same wavelength as those other two. So we'll be right back.
Well, you do that, and I'm going to give my wife her phone.
Yeah, but that'd be great.
Okay.
Okay, and give her a kiss. I'll be right here. I'm going to drink water.
If I could tell you what's going on with my poor wife.
Boy, if your wife could talk.
We're redoing the master bathroom. And we're at this phase now where it's, does the countertop marble go with the floor? And does it go with the interior of the shower? And maybe it's not that marble. And should it be subway tile? Or should we paint it? And I can't get the architect and the thing. And she's an artist, right? So if she gets it wrong, these things really, we redid our pool. I love it. And she goes, the tile is the wrong color for the water. Don't you see it? Don't you see it? And I go, you're going to, and it makes her crazy. Every time she sees the pool, it's like a knife in the heart. So she's got
to
get this.
I will give advice to you on this. The subway tile, let her know the only problem with it is it smells like urine.
Darling.
And it might have bum feces. And I mean that without meaning bum. That was a horrible thing to say, but it's a.
Not today.
It's a 40s way of saying something that we don't want to talk about today.
Sure,
so many people are. Now, so many people are hurting. So many injustices have been happening. It's before COVID. I was out. You were out doing your tour. You were actually doing your character. And you were, it's all 5 years ago. And I felt, and I don't know if you did, maybe you didn't, but I felt dissension in the audience. I felt anger. I felt, and I think it was politically driven at first. Mm-hmm. It was right before the elections, and everybody started picking their teams, and it was like the Flyers hockey team years ago. Everybody just went like, oh, you're red or blue. I hate you. You know, people live 200 miles from another city. They hate the other city. I'd perform, the audience would be diverse, and then I would hear someone make a racist comment, which I wasn't hearing for a while. I guess, and the truth is, it was swept under the rug for all these years. So now the needle went and moved, and it's still in a giant moving process. And where do you fall on this? Because I wouldn't call you an activist. I would call you a compassionate man who cares.
Yeah. I'm an activist in the sense of when there's a particular cause or campaign that I really feel has would be impactful, I try to support it. And I kind of got elevated in that during the first Obama election, where I became a surrogate for him and I went out on the road and you know, was doing events on his behalf.
And so you're not saying you impregnated Michelle Obama, a surrogate?
I'm not saying that, but I'm not pointing to it. Okay.
Wow, well, that's a good credit. I put that above activist on your bio.
Well, so you got to be pretty active, you know.
You get it to your Wikipedia page as soon as
we're right? Exactly. You don't think Malia has a little bit of a resemblance? Come on.
Oh my God, I never thought of it.
Nobody does. It's the perfect.
Does she argue over the bill and coffee and things like that?
But it even back then, you know, I would go into places and get confronted for having a candidate, you know, and I would always say, look, I don't have a gun to your head. I'm just here talking about why this feels right to me and why it's attractive and to try and articulate and engage with people who maybe haven't figured out what they want to do yet. I'm not here to, you know, to trash. But you're right. The anger has been coming for a while. I have a theory about all of it, and I will share it with you. So you remember Y2K, right?
Yeah. I use it. I used it this morning.
Absolutely. And it's a 2K for you as opposed to a 4K.
No.
Well, but
my parents said take a little off the top, and they went too far.
It went too far. They all do. But when that didn't happen, when we didn't have catastrophe from flipping into the 21st century, I think we all went, it was a calendar page. No big deal.
Right.
But I think what we are seeing is that the 21st century and the 20th century are very different creatures. They are existentially different. There are two new generations of people on this planet that only know the 21st century. And what I see happening is...
Do you want me to get that?
No, it's okay. It's the front door and you wouldn't be able to open the lock.
I want to come over. So, Don Rickles, I'm so lonely.
But I think it is the fact that there's a tear at the seams of the fabric between the last century and this century. There is a big thrust of progressive thought, and there is a lot of advancing we must do in order to survive. We have got to change the climate. We have got to change our economic structures. We've got to change our social structures. Our injustices have to finally, you know, the population of our planet is no longer white dominant. And so this, you know, the treatment and the repression and the suppression of our minority classes are finally having to be addressed in a way, because they ain't minorities anymore, and the abuse is now well documented. So there's all this stuff that's tearing, and conservatives, by their very nature, are afraid of change. They get threatened by change.
And that's understandable as a human race. It's understandable to not want change.
Yes.
To want things as they are. But I have a lot of friends that are Republican. That's not a big deal. But
right. But
far right thinking, some very extreme far right. It's difficult when someone believes things that you know or just aren't the world's round, you know.
Absolutely.
But I have friends that I go, well, that is a good point. You know, I understand that. I understand why that hurts you.
Yep.
And I kind of agree with you. And then we go to the woke world, and that's what we started to talk about a minute ago, which is I'm out doing stand up and I'm going, wait a minute. I'm not going to stop doing this. I'm not going to say the same stuff that I did, because it's hurtful. Right. I don't want to hit those words. I'm not a person capable of saying those sick jokes that at one time were done to hold up. Look how sick and sad this is by doing the sick joke. But that doesn't, you know, sarcasm, facetiousness is not readable by the new generation, and understandably, actually. But if it's so woke that I can't just make everybody, I have to somehow make everybody laugh and be happy with whatever I do.
Very hard. I'm part of so many organizations right now that are trying to do good things, and they go, don't you think comedy would be good in this? I go, be careful. Because comedy, by its very nature, is always potentially hurtful to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
If you're blonde and I make a blonde joke, let's do me. I'm a short, fat, bald, Jewish white guy. If I'm sitting in an audience and somebody does a joke about any of that and I'm hypersensitive, I get offended. Are they trying to hurt my feelings? No, they're trying to play with me. They're trying to engage me. We're talking about human foibles. We're talking about the silliness of existence on this planet. And we're trying to enjoy each other. But if I'm having a bad day and he makes a ball joke and I go, fuck you, now it's a thing and he's in trouble. And that's where we are. Comedy is so needed. It is so essential right now. Our ability to laugh with each other and go, you know what? We're all a little bit foolish. We're all trying to figure it out. We all make mistakes. Can we just enjoy each other? You know, and we'll do better tomorrow. Let's laugh tonight. It's so needed. And yet it is so in the crosshairs right now for what you do. I don't really do stand up, but what you do and our friends who do it with you, mm-hmm. my hat gets tipped and I salute because you're actually soldiers in a very necessary cause right now, but at,
right.
there are landmines everywhere, and you guys can get blown up. So can I, but you're out there in a more profound way.
Well, I actually detonated one of my legs, so they feel bad. That it adds sympathy to be missing.
You were too tall anyway. Don't worry about it.
Right?
No, so it just makes you human.
And I stand in a hole with my good leg.
There you go. That's fine.
You can't do that. You can't say that. You can't make that a joke because there's people missing limbs. And then no matter what you say, if you stop and think about it, what I've been trying to do is tee it up with an apology before and after something that might be offensive, right. which makes my show twice as long.
And half as funny.
Half as funny. But it's fun to watch me dangle. But like you've done so many, I mean, okay, I didn't meet you, but you did a movie in the very beginning of your life. I didn't know you when you did commercials for Delta Gold potato chips.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I did them, and mine they didn't use, and you did them. I did 3 campaigns for them. Something didn't work, and you were the Delta Gold guy, and I watched it, and I went, he is so much better than I was.
Very kind, but I'm sure they wrote that copy, and I just did what they wrote. But
that, yeah. You can't go, this is writer-driven, the Delta Gold potato chips.
Well, that's true. It was a magic persona and intent. But
and they discontinued the product, which is a testament to the writing.
I'm very good at being the death knell in most products that are on the
I don't agree.
On the margin.
After you did that, what would be the most consequential thing that you did? Because you were always doing theater as well.
I had a crazy run. So all through the 80s, I was doing the thing that I dreamed about when I was a kid. I had no film or television fantasies. I wanted to work on the Broadway stage.
Yeah.
And I was doing it. I did 5 Broadway shows in the 80s and 4 off-Broadway shows.
You won the Tony and a Grammy for Jerome Robbins Broadway.
Yeah, I don't have the Grammy. I hear that I've won it, but I don't have it. It's not in my hand.
I don't get that. You need some concrete evidence. You deserve the jewelry.
Absolutely, but I won the Tony in 1989. And then within the course of a year, it was Tony Award, Pretty Woman, Seinfeld. And it was like, Jesus Christ, that's a left turn I did not see coming.
Right.
And then, you know, Pretty Woman was a big deal for my life. Seinfeld, certainly. And then there were things that, you know, I've been lucky enough to be in a bunch of stuff. None of it has expired. I mean, Shallow Hal was a big film, but.
You got a little nub of a tail. I'm happy.
Yeah, yeah. That was a strange little tail. But, you know, the opportunities that all that stuff brought me were extraordinary. I mean, they weren't huge successes in the marketplace, but in your life, you go, this was, boy, was I lucky to be a part of this. I got so much out of that. So, and that's kind of where I am now. Most of the stuff I've done post-Seinfeld has been smaller and inarguably less successful. And I teach and I talk to students all the time now, and they talk about, you know, well, are they failures? And I go, well, they're failures in that they didn't get a big audience. They're failures in that the person putting money into it didn't get paid back.
Right.
Are they failures for me? I met great people. I did exciting, interesting, challenging things. I had a lot of laughs. I learned shit. And some of it, as far as my own evaluation, some of it is really good work that I wouldn't have gotten to do anywhere else.
Right.
So is it a failure? I mean,
no.
Personally,
people care about the hits. That's what they care about. They don't think that consequential work, because it is about the work. And they think, oh, people are saying it's about the work. That just means because it wasn't successful, that's what they fall back on.
Right.
And they are so out of it. They don't understand anything.
Absolutely.
I've done shows that are one season, and you've done that. I was on one of yours that I liked. Where, what was the one you were a politician?
I wasn't a politician. Well, so I did a thing called Bob Patterson, which was the motivational speaker. Then I did one where I was basically playing, having a senior moment, a sportscaster that has a real show.
Was that it? It was a CBS show.
Yeah, with Malcolm Jamal Warner.
That's the one. And I came in and played. And
we were sportscasters on that.
That's why I thought that you were political. Yeah. Because we if you're a sportscaster now, you can run for president.
Yeah. And then the last series I did, honestly, almost nobody saw it. And I thought it was one of the best shows I've ever done in my life. It was something that my partner, Peter Tilden, and I created called Hit the Road, which was about a highly dysfunctional Partridge family who lives on a tour bus, tries to be America's wholesome, all-American band. And behind the scenes, we're fuck you up yours. Hey, you little shit. You know, it's and that was great fun, but we only got one season out of it.
Can we find that anywhere?
It plays in Canada because we shot it in Canada. Mm-hmm. It was made for the DirecTV audience channel.
Got it.
Big viewership to begin with. And and it didn't last there. So there might be some of it on YouTube or Canadian TV. But
well, there's another chapter coming up that's going to have a lot of different facets to it for you. Whatever, I'll tell you. I saw you and Marty Short and the producers. I took my parents to it. I saw it twice with both of you, and it was astonishing because here you are doing something that most people can't do, and it's not Matthew and Nathan, and then but it didn't matter. You owned it. It was so wonderful. I mean, you're in your element. I mean, you're also doing, you know, something so well written, but you have a facility.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a little hard to, it's a little, especially the way I give all credit for that show, really, to Susan Stroman, who directed and choreographed it. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the songs are good, but they're not standalone songs. They're not, you know, they're not going to lift out of that show and be popular tunes. And the jokes in many ways are as old as the movie. You really need somebody brilliant had to come along and put a shape on this thing and then populate it with people that know how to do borscht belt, baggy pants, silliness, you know, and keep Gary Beach is the perfect example, rest his soul, of a guy who was mad as a hatter, but knew exactly what he was doing every step of the way. And she and Mel populated that show with people like that. So it was glorious. You know?
And that's the other thing. You've always, people that are incredibly funny, Pretty Woman, Gary Marshall. I mean, one of the sweetest, best timing, best mental acuity. Is that a word?
Yeah.
Does it pertain to what I was saying?
Not at all.
I need a thesaurus just for me specifically. And then, you know, you're looking at Larry. Your bar is incredibly high, and I'm not saying that's not a short joke. I'm saying, you know, when you go to the bar, I'm just saying that to get a cocktail napkin, you got to reach.
I have to. Well, first of all, I have to have someone do it for me because they don't believe I'm 62. I look like a ball child. My suit is a 44 toddler. I understand.
You actually are adorable. I mean, you are, and there hasn't been a time when we see each other that we don't actually hug each other, and it lasts.
Because I adore you.
I adore you.
What people don't know about you is A, you're talented. B,
they don't know that.
They don't know that. And B, you are, you know, and not just to be kind, you are, whenever somebody needs a hand, whenever somebody needs help, they have a charity, they have a thing, your name comes up. And if you are literally not physically in another place, you are always there. Your heart is wide open.
That's you.
And you and I also bonded. We have a special bond because of our sisters. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Both of our sisters stricken with scleroderma.
Indeed.
And you've done a lot to help move that needle forward. And what do we do? You know, it's an orphan disease, and yet hundreds of thousands of people have it. And I'm sure you meet people all the time because we're both poster boys for it in a way of the celebrity variety, which is, I'll take it. You know, if I can help do it, that's a That's when people go, oh, you showbiz people. Well, really? Well, I'm going to try to help, you know, cure AIDS for children.
Right.
And I'm doing it because why wouldn't a human being do that? And if you're
well, there is no other, as I'm sure you have found, there is no other good use for celebrity. Because celebrity, it's a curse word.
I always say
it's a gift that you cannot give yourself. So people have to give it to you. And you don't always want it. Sometimes it's a bad tie. You know, it's just, you don't want to wear it every day, but you have no choice. But
it's taking a selfie at your father's funeral. That's just wrong.
Bingo. That's exactly right. But it does have an upside. It does have perks. And because of that, I think it also comes with certain responsibilities. And one of them is, if you can cast reflected light on something that has value and is important, you are called to that service, but not everybody responds to it. And you certainly do. And I try to, and that's one of the times between us.
I think you did before me, even though you're 3 years younger than me or four. It's really disturbing the age, but, I can't believe we're getting older. I mean,
look at your hair. Come on.
Well, I do things. I mean, I color the crown and then they feather it, but I have it. But it gets this is gray. This is not bald. It's weird. I have low mane, but you're looking at me going, Bob, why complain?
That's right. You're saying. You know, I use Rogaine to maintain this. So that's how desperate.
I was going to put a rainbird in the middle of my head.
Sure, why not?
And fertilize it, which means you got to find the right woman. Oh my God, sorry. Yeah, but we have that bond to try to. And in our lifetime, are we going to cure scleroderma? No, but we're going to help. I mean, there is research being done that they're really doing.
And you know the other unspeakably cruel malady that I've become connected to is ALS. I lost a cousin during the pandemic.
I'm sorry.
And her family's journey through that was extraordinary. But that's another one where it's just a cruel disease. It makes no sense in nature as scleroderma doesn't. And they're all in these autoimmune genetic diseases. So I feel like now that we have, you know, mapped the human genome, if we can zero in on the defect that creates a scleroderma and cut it at its source, I think we're closer to a cure than we are to a treatment because of this genetic coding. But there are so many potential answers in that genome that getting to the one that makes the difference without doing any damage. It will take a while.
There are some very fortunate people, very fortunate, that had the money and it worked to get a stem cell transplant on all of these diseases. Literally, they've tried it on every single one, from cancer to ALS to MS. And it doesn't always work. I mean, it's a major thing you're doing to your body. But the real research is, as you were alluding to, there's going to be an aha moment that happens in a lab. And whatever that is, whatever disease is getting that, whatever autoimmune disease is being researched, that news is going to get spread. And it's going to affect all of them. It's going to affect all the, because they're in a similar category.
Right.
They just do things to the body and to the mind that are unthinkable.
And you and I have known people who have lived with these things. Now, I got to tell you, if I have a headache, Or I hurt my finger, I'm a miserable prick.
I woke up miserable this morning.
I
have a cold sore in my mouth.
Okay.
I'm calling 911.
Right. And yet my sister, your sister, my cousin, people I know that have lived with what turned out to be fatal cancers have borne it with a grace and a humor that I know I've been exposed to so that I can try and learn, you know, what it is to rise to that. But it is unimaginable to me. And their families bearing through it with them. It's what people are capable of under the worst of situations and with the cards being dealt really poorly is extraordinary. And I don't know why. And I write in my journal every night and I go to my therapist and I go, the shoe has got to drop. I have been disproportionately blessed throughout my entire life.
Right.
Something terrible is I'm going to be drawn and quartered. I mean, something this nobody gets through a lifetime like this. And I see this misery all around us. And that is the other reason, going back to what we were talking about, where people have said to me, why do you put yourself out as a public advocate? You're going to offend people. You're going to lose half your audience. Blah, blah, blah. And I go, nothing I advocate for truly is a direct benefit to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to lower my taxes. I'm not trying to give myself a better school. I'm advocating for people who aren't getting a fair shake, who are not seeing justice, who aren't being given the same opportunities I'm being given. What do you want me to do? Shut up and let them go on like this? And the other thing that amazes me about people who go, well, you know, that's their problem. They got to pick themselves up by their bootstraps. I go, right. Do you know what people do when they hit the wall and there's no choice and there's no place else to run? You know what they do? They turn and they fight back. And I'm a student of history. You know, the French Revolution, not a great thing for people who were doing well. Not great. Right. So, you know, it would be nice if we could create a planet where everyone has, you know, a quality of life that is satisfactory.
But that does seem impossible, doesn't it? Because there's a huge faction that it's not about people that are wealthy and want things to be the same. It's not just about that. It's about just human condition. People's IQs and people's different ways.
Yeah, and we're also born into, geographically, you know, talk about throw the dice. I'm born into suburban middle class New Jersey in 1959. That's a good role, right?
What
if
exit?
I had been born into...
What exit was it?
5A off the 280. but if I had been born into, an underclass in India to a family of 12, my potential for success is not equivalent in those two scenarios. And that is a happenstance of birth. And so we will never have utopia. We will never get to a place where everyone has a sort of equal opportunity to thrive. We won't, but we can get.
I keep hoping, but what we've been going through, I'm hoping, and I'm feeling positive that we're going to like fail forward, that because this is a failing time, and it seems gloomy and hopeless, but I don't think that, because I think people get exhausted emotionally of still fighting a fight for what? For what? It's why people get divorced. It's why neighbors, why brothers don't talk anymore. Besides embezzling all the money or having sex with the man's wife.
Sure.
And COVID isn't good for that because you don't meet that many people.
No. And when you embezzle, you can't travel. So it is
difficult. There's no knapsack, no hopping a freight.
No.
And I love this blurry thing. And I might decide to go this
way. Right? Yeah. Absolutely.
So if you got,
we're figuring out. So I told you when you called me, my buddy Peter Tilden and I are, We've recorded 12 episodes of a podcast that we're about to go out with. And so I'm in your boat now. I'm learning every one of these that I do. I'm learning.
How many have you done? You've done.
We've done 12, and it's the podcast will be called Really No Really. And it stemmed from Peter and I do this all the time where he goes, did you hear something? And I go, really? No, really? You know, that's how it came from. And The actual Jerry Seinfeld, dig hard enough, he'll be at the heart of the rest of my life. So Seinfeld does two routines where I went, well, yeah, I wonder why that is. And one of them was he would do this very funny routine about how in public restrooms, the stall door doesn't come down to the floor. And you have this little pathetic viewing window of feet and pants and a belt. And you know, it's like, why? Why? If you go to a fine hotel, you go to the restroom, you have your own little room, right? But in in high traffic public restrooms, why don't the doors go down to the floor? We found out the answer. And the other one was, he does a, God bless him, he does a really funny bit about 5 hour energy shots.
Yeah.
Why are they 5 hours? Yeah. Who needs 5 hours of energy? An hour, 2 hours, 8 hours, five. And we have unearthed that. So we are talking to people who are engaged with something where you go, really? We talked to a woman, a speech therapist, who with recorded buttons on the floor has taught her dog 55 words. And there is profound communication going on. And she's starting to offer this, you know, to other people.
So are any of them clean words, or is it all filth?
They're all, you know, there's shit, but I think it's in literally, I have to go. I think that's
what I see.
But we talked to her. We've talked to competitive eaters. We have talked to a guy, a wonderful guy, who is a former neo-Nazi skinhead who left the movement partially because of his love for the Seinfeld show.
Really?
We talked to...
Was that the soup Nazi that did that?
No. It was a guy named Arno Michaelis, and he's extraordinary. We've talked to a woman, a wonderful woman in her 40s, a Latinx descent, who does sign language interpretation for rap stars, where she's dropping F-bombs and C-bombs and N-words and, you know, and at 1,000 miles an hour, you know, talking to her about that stuff. We have talked to a guy who's been in the circus all his life, and currently his wife shoots him out of a cannon 8 times a day. Thank you very much.
I almost want to see this live. Have you guys thought of that?
We thought in success it would be fun to do them live, and we are, you know, we're Zooming them all, so we have the video component, but
right.
We had a great time. We just haven't launched it quite yet, because with a show like this, part of it is presentational, and you want to know, when should we be talking? When is it really an interview? When do we do a bit? When do we do a thing? So we've been, you know, editing and re-editing and going back and forth to try to get a nice format for it. But I would imagine sometime in October, November, we're going to try and start to put them up and see if there's an audience for it. But it's been great fun. It's a joy to do.
I'm excited for that. I will listen to that. I have to pick and choose, because there's more podcasts than there are people. A gazillion.
Yeah, I know. Listen, I must really like you, because I have a lot of people that go, hey, want to have a conversation? I went, I've told every story I have at this point.
And you told this on here, I think. Well, we had a conversation, I think. So you told the same stories about Seinfeld, which you've been asked literally a zillion times.
Yeah.
But, you know, his stand-up is something that it's hard to find something to be angry about. With his stand-up and a show about nothing, which it wasn't. It was about relationships, but it is also something we could really use right now, because it really, there's no sides picking here, unless it's one of those episodes that's bringing up,
right?
You know, someone's going to go out and do a march and don't do it, and then you're bringing up stuff. But
right.
Jerry's stand-up has always been, since I knew him when I was 22, so accessible, purposely crafted. Perfectly crafted. So.
Yeah, you know, when I've done interviews and people say, "Well, who's your favorite stand up?" and I would always say, you know, I don't mean favorite in, you know, joke by joke, pound for pound, but I watched over the years that I worked with Jerry, I must have seen him do 30 stand up sets, you know, mm-hmm. Outside of our show. I've seen him work. Old audiences, young audiences, not the brightest, you know, bulb audiences, hostile audiences. He gets them. There's no crowd.
Yeah.
He can't win. And that to me makes him one of the finest, you know, other guys and gals cannot sort of tailor the set to figure out where the sweet spot's going to be. Jerry's got so much material and so much history and such an innate sense of, and then like that, I think here, I've seen a lot of live comics. I've just never seen anybody with quite that savant ability to understand and work a crowd. and to get the hell off. He also knows.
Well, he's I've talked to him about it, and he said an hour and 10. That's kind of the perfect length.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then if you're going to work new stuff in, you kind of do it near the front. And then, but that can vary. It depends on what fits, because he's so meticulous. I mean, he's such a crafts person.
I've never seen a work ethic like that. You know, when I knew him, I think what he said is when he could, he was working, writing for an hour or two a day. I mean, he could sit and either brainstorm ideas or look at material and recraft it. And, you know, who does that?
I actually spent a lot of time, but, you know, it's a lot of dick jokes don't need punching up.
No.
You know, they're done. They're out of the gate. They're done.
Right. Words with a K are funny, you know.
And a P.
Dick.
Dick and penis. So.
And penis. Yeah. Sure.
That's right. Dickus would be good, but it's Latin. And I think we've lost.
It was also, wasn't that the name of the main guy in District 9, where he's becoming an alien? I think his name was Dickus.
You're correct.
Yeah. Which was, I went, are you fucking kidding me?
And then in Life of Brian, Monty Python, Michael Palin kept saying his friend, Biggest Dickus.
Right.
and they all kept laughing. And he goes, why are you laughing? At my, right. And he got right into his face, my friend, Biggest Dickus. And it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. So your influences, real quick, who changed your life when you found out you wanted to do Broadway, when you found out you wanted to do musical comedy, theater?
When I was 12 years old and I saw Pippin for the first time, Ben Vereen made me want to be an actor. I had never thought about it up until that point. I saw what he did on that stage, and I had such a man crush on him and his talent that I started to go in that direction. I had an amazing professor. I went to college at Boston University as a theater major, but I saw myself as a dramatic actor. And this guy, James Spruill, pulled me into his office in my sophomore year.
He didn't touch you, right?
He did not. He touched my heart. I was, you know, a good 15 to 20 pounds overweight. I had hit my full height potential of 5'5", and I was already starting to lose my hair. And he said, look, I know your heart and soul is Hamlet, and you would be a profound Hamlet. You're never going to play Hamlet. So you better get good at Falstaff. And he said, you're not seeing yourself as a comedian. You're not looking at comedic material or seeing yourself as a comedic actor. If you want a commercially successful career, you're going to be more marketable if you go that route. And I had never thought about it. And I took him very seriously. And because of that, he really changed my career. I mean, I had done a couple of comedies, but it was not what I was focused on. It was not what I was looking for. So that was a big influence. And then once I started doing that, the comedic voices that I really started paying attention to try and figure out who's funny? How do you make funny? You know, where everybody that had a record, from Woody Allen and Bob Newhart to Cosby and Carlin and Phyllis Diller and Jose Jimenez and you name it, you know.
Right.
Those
are canceled, a couple of those people.
You bet. Comedy and lives don't always hold up. But and then, you know, from Lucille Ball and Jackie Gleason to the Marx Brothers to, again, Newhart and Jerry Lewis and what makes comedy? What, and I would steal from everybody.
Right. But to your teacher's fault, you know, Willie Loman, I mean, there are characters that you, Jackie Gleason was a hell of a serious
character.
And so are you. I've seen you do stuff.
You're
and
very
within bad. Comedy, doing it properly. The best is pathos. The best is when there's a serious root to it. And you are a person who's always so prepared that you might be doing something with the quippiest and smartest kind of dialogue that's funny, and it's meant to be funny, and it comes out funny. But I know you well enough to know that there's a deep root to it, and that's why it's so funny.
Well, you're very kind.
I'll tell you the truth. Don't you find that when you do... when you're
well, it's the way that I work. You know, I've had a lot of training and a lot of teachers, but the guy that became my guru was Larry Moss, who's still out there teaching.
Yep.
And Larry really gave me a way to work at stuff. And so no matter what I'm working, it could be funniest stuff in the world, I still have to take this journey through the truth of it. And so I think that hopefully some of that journey is always present in the end result. You know?
Well, I don't know what to say. I want to see you. So I want to figure out,
I want to be with you. Who's the first person to sing that song? Let's see if you're a Broadway queen like me. First person to sing, I want to be with you after all these nights of loving you.
Nelson Eddy.
Nope. Not even close.
Eddie.
Now I'll give you the show. Broadway show called Golden Boy.
Sammy?
Sammy Davis Jr., baby.
Wow.
Yep.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
I would have
never saw him do that show, but I have the album, and
lived. You know, I do want to say, I know that you are as emotional as I am. I've had a couple of Broadway experiences, and it felt, of all the award shows that we've been watching, which were done in COVID and Zoom and pain, and like, why'd they produce it that way? And we all had notes, and everybody's like, but watching the Tonys, it was, I did Abridged. I can't sit through a whole thing anymore because I'm 12. But it felt so great. And it let us feel that, yes, we're getting through this. It's not going to be easy. This is something that people have to realize is real and it ain't going away. And just, you know, you do what you want to do, but take the fucking shot. So
you know why I think it resonates like that, the Tonys? And I'm going to be a theater snob now. That community is an actual community. The community of the theater.
Yes.
And the reason that's true is the biggest star in the world that gets up and does 8 a week knows if the chorus girl 3 lines back doesn't do her job, nothing I do is going to matter to this audience because that's what they're going to see. So if I don't have their support, if we're not in this together, none of this works. And we have to do it today and tomorrow and twice the next day. And so you learn what ensemble is all about. And the ensemble of one show is the same as the show next door and the show next door. And at 8 o'clock, you're all communally doing this miraculous thing. And that's what you see in that room. When the Tonys happen, they are a brother and sisterhood. They are cheering for each other. 100%. They are proud of each other.
And it's a role model for existence. That's why people, for human existence and collaboration and empathy. Yeah. And you might not like someone. There's always a thing where you go, whether it's a film, a TV show, or a play, you go, oh, there's an asshole on everyone, on every production. I just hope it's not me.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I was doing, last thing I did on Broadway was Hand to God. And
oh my God. Did you do that?
I took over for Mark Kudish.
Wish I had seen that.
I wish you had too.
I saw the original company and I was blown away by that.
Everybody
play.
Was, everyone was the original company. Oh. It was, you know, Geneva Carr and Sarah Stiles
And
Stephen Boyer. Jeez, God in heaven.
I could not understand that performance. He's mouthing and working a puppet on one hand and reacting to the puppet.
It's the most amazing. It's the most amazing.
My head exploded.
Demonic puppet, and I wish it hadn't ended, but these shows are difficult to get, you know, and it's also a specific audience, but it was everybody that would love rock and roll and all of the dark things. And comedy, funny as shit. So,
I am supposed to direct one. We're casting now. That is funny and dark and theatrical. To direct a stage adaptation written by Peter Tolan, who created Rescue Me. Of The War of the Roses.
Oh, I read that. That's like so great.
Yeah,
so you have, and you're doing it up in Cambridge? You're doing up?
No, we were supposed to do it in Maine before the pandemic.
That's how my information gets.
Yeah, and then now we're putting it together straight from New York. So
awesome.
You know, hopefully within the next year it gets up. But it's, I mean, you want to talk about dark and funny and
yeah.
Oof. Yeah.
And the, and do you have a chandelier?
Are
you,
we have a chandelier.
That's the money shot.
We
can
have
you
a
find one in storage from Phantom?
It will be very carefully built to carry off this stunt. But yeah.
I wanted to mention that I didn't bring up that I was in Hand to God for any reason except to say that talking about one thing that can go wrong, the dancer doesn't hit the cue, yeah. Something doesn't. I had to put keys in a door. The set was revolving, and it was moving as I was doing the key movement, and my sleeve got caught on the side of the flat, and it's a hydraulic movement. It was, yeah. And I literally could have died. And I looked to the one of the lovely stage men next to me, and he just looked at me like, holy shit. And it was all a split second. And I would have been wedged into a flat, obviously would have thrown off the timing of the show. But it's because of, and that was the only time I did something that really screwed up other people, could have screwed up other people.
Yeah,
but it really is amazing. If you don't put the cup exactly where it has to be, you can actually murder someone.
It's astonishing. The fact that, especially these elaborate Broadway musicals, it's like a NASA mission.
Yeah.
The amount of stuff that has to coordinate to pull it off. And, you know, the audience is just thinking, like, oh, it's fantastic. You know, but it's backstage, it's controlled mayhem and thrilling. And, you and I have that in our DNA. We're going out to actors right now for this show. Wonderful, brilliant actors who go, I don't do stage, man. I don't do stage. They're scared. And rightly so.
It was the best thing that ever happened to me. Kevin McCullum put me in Drowsy Chaperone, and I took over for Bob Martin and for many other great actors.
Yeah. Like
three other people. And I got to work with Danny Burstyn, who finally...
won his Tony, finally.
Won his Tony, yeah. And we were talking about ALS earlier, and his amazing...
Becca, yeah.
Was... so beautiful and so perfect. And Danny, yeah, is, not unlike yourself, one of the more lovely people,
oh,
I get to know in my
absolute life. Angel. An angel of a guy.
He is so special. And he almost lost his life to COVID. And he's another open heart. It's just so beautiful.
Agreed.
He's, and David Alan Grier won. And thank God, or we'd have to listen to that for another 10 years. But he's amazing.
You might have seen this too. I saw the first time I ever saw David was in the a musical about Jackie Robinson called The First. And it probably played in 1982 or three. And he played Jackie Robinson. And the show didn't run. But I remember saying to my wife, there's another star right there. That's a bright light. And, you know, it, again, yeah, he's had a glorious career, but it's taken all this time.
Yeah.
To have somebody pat him on the back and go, you know, you're pretty damn good.
And he can do anything.
Anything.
Another, so could you. You're,
yeah, you're
an incredibly talented person, and I'm honored to have you as a friend.
So thank you, my brother. Right back at you.
Thank you.
So,
thanks for doing
a little
podcast. If you need me on yours to do jump through a flaming hoop.
I need you to. We're going to find your really, no, really. The thing that you tell us where we go, really? Sodomize the camel. I cannot believe it. But
I had an apple box. I have four penises, and I'm doing a musical called Quadrupenia.
There you go.
That's
I love it. It writes itself.
You love it. No one else does. If I can't get a response out of you
I'll talk to Kevin McCullum. He'll put on anything.
If I'm in it, you know he'll put on anything. Well, I love you, Jason.
Thank you, Bobby.
And I'll be over. I want to pick up your wife's phone so I can just stay direct in contact.
Absolutely. God knows where it is now. Wherever she may be.
Be well. I'll talk to you. Well, that's Jason Alexander. And what a wonderful, wonderful, honest, loving man. I hope you enjoyed that. I did. I loved talking with him. And I never asked him any of those questions. You know, you have a friend. You don't go, hey, so what was it like with the finale of Seinfeld? He's got so much coming up, and there's also, I think, another show in him that's going to last a long time, because he's beloved by a lot of you, or beloved, or he's just a special, wonderful, talented man. So thank you for listening to this episode. Listen to Jason's podcast with Peter Tilden when it comes out. And what else can we tell you? Go see his War of the Roses production. It's gone to Broadway. Holy God in heaven. He's just, you get what you get with him, which is just love. He's a talented, wonderful man who, for some reason, has his wife's phone on his desk. I'm sending you guys all my best. I know you might be going through some tough times. You might be angry. You might be just trying to think things aren't difficult right now, but they are for you. I wish you well. I really do. We're all just getting through, right? And I'm going to be out on tour. Just go to bobsaget.com. You can find out what clubs or theaters I'm coming to. And the plan is to do a special before the end of the year, so I got to figure that out. And I love what I'm doing, which is getting to make people laugh, which is no small order these days. So it's an honor to be able to entertain people again. And I'll keep doing it until they say I can't, which probably won't happen because I'll just keep doing it. And eventually I'll be old enough, I'll just be a head on a stick. I only need some mic. Oh, yeah, and I got to be alive. Anyway, hey, just be well. You can watch us on the YouTube page, which is just youtube.com/Bob Saget. And you can go to bobsaget.com for tickets for my shows. And we've got a lot of great new guests coming up right here on the show called Bob Saget's Here For You. It's very awkward to say my name. I mean, I find it awkward to say Here For You even, because there is another podcast named Here For You, which I didn't know, but Bob Saget's name wasn't before it, because I'm Bob Saget. How awkward does that sound? Would you, if your name's Jim Smith, would you go, because I'm Jim Smith? No, you wouldn't. That's a problem I have. It really is. But I'm going to call my therapist really soon after I do Pilates. Nope, there's 9 jokes in there. I'm not doing them. Take care of yourselves. You know, you rate, review, you subscribe to this podcast. And you can subscribe and listen. Or if you're getting it on a place where you follow and listen. Whatever you got to do, I'm here. And I'm sending you my best. Take care, everybody.